This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Andrew McCarthy's new book, The Longest Way Home, is part memoir and part travelogue. It's mostly about coming to terms a few years ago with his desire for solitude and foreign places, with his attachment to his fiancée, their child, and his child from his first marriage. He went to Patagonia, Mount Kilimanjaro, Costa Rica, the Amazon, while he and Dee made and unmade plans for their wedding. His book is subtitled One Man's Quest for the Courage to Settle Down. Andrew McCarthy was an actor before he became an award-winning travel writer. He was 19 when he appeared in his first film, Class. He then starred in St. Elmo's Fire, Pretty in Pink, Less Than Zero, and has continued to act in the movies, on TV, and in theater. He's also worked as a director, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And nice to have you with us on the show, and congratulations on your book.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. Does the book tour count as travel?
I think it's the anti-travel. It's an interesting experience, I have to say. It's one I've never had before, in the sense that I've done a lot of publicity for movies and television and things, and that's different because you're much more doing a kind of presentational sense of yourself, whereas the book is much more of a, hopefully, a revealing. And so when I'm talking about it, it's much more of an open, naked experience than I've had before, which I'm finding surprisingly liberating.
Well, that's interesting, because it's very clear, as you write, that you are a person who has, for a lot of his life, really gravitated to solitude, to being alone. But you've also, you know, lived a very public life, and here you are on a book tour meeting strangers, asking you all sorts of questions, and you're used to meeting strangers, but perhaps not asking questions in this same kind of a format, if you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's a weird life. I think you're right. I mean, for someone... Although I think a lot of actors are shy people or introverts, and it was interesting how I sort of found acting as my way out of myself. I don't know what would have happened to me had I not found acting, and I have led a public life to a degree, in that I've been recognizable since I was in my early 20s. So it helped form a lot of what my personality was to become. You know, when I was in my early 20s, I had no idea who I was or any of that. You know, I was still a mold of clay, you know, yet to be formed. And so that helped form me to a very real degree that I think it's a weird thing. I think fame is a weird thing, and it stunts, and it sort of pours Miracle-Gro on your different attributes and liabilities. And I think that was the case with me.
And do you want to pick up on that? I'd love to have you read, though, a section from near the beginning of the book. And in a sense, you're a young boy here.
Yes, I was... Yeah, I'll just read that then.
Okay.
As a boy, I was prone to worry and fret. But that night, as I lay still under the stars, a feeling of calm spread over me. I suddenly had a conscious realization of what it felt like to be alive. I had never considered my life, but now, in that instant, a flood of gratitude washed over me, and I felt an expansiveness. Softly, the distance between the stars and me disappeared. I wasn't closer to them or they to me, but the distance became insignificant. Pliable. The size of my body swelled, and I was huge. For a boy who was very small for his age, this sensation was thrilling. I was no longer bound by the rules that governed physics. Size and distance became changeable, then vanished entirely. I grabbed at this feeling in order to possess it, but in my clutching, it began to slip away. I softened my grasp, and the sense of fluidity returned. I rode it like a wave. I have no idea how long this went on, but eventually my brother Peter came outside and found me. I asked him, "Do you ever feel like you're changing sizes?" He just looked at me. For years after that night, I had occasional accidental moments in which my sense of size and perspective shifted, and I felt like I understood something that I normally forgot. Feelings of separation dissolved, yet I was aware of my ultimate aloneness. This paradox provoked in me a sense of freedom and relief, relief that what I was aware of on a faint subconscious level was a strong and satisfying truth.
And that's Andrew McCarthy reading from his new book. I love that passage, and we should probably set that up just a little bit. You're a young boy. You're in New Jersey. You're outside looking at this vast sky.
Yeah, I'd gone out to make snow angels in the snow after a snowstorm, and I found myself instead just laying looking up at the sky, and it was a real moment of clarity in a certain way that I had never experienced, and it was a huge relief. And that paradox of feeling I'd always felt alone without knowing that I'd felt alone until that moment I became aware of connection, which allowed me to realize how alone I'd always felt. And so, and now the two coexisted in me. And I suppose that's been my life struggle and challenge for my entire life. Yeah.
And you must have seen other skies that give you that same experience of vastness, of connection, of aloneness, you know, all at the same time.
Yeah,
other skies in your travels?
Yeah, I think the sky certainly does that. And vast open spaces. I love traveling to open spaces. I love going to the Sahara. I had a very similar experience. And down in Patagonia, I have the same experience. I love looking up and seeing the Southern Cross in the sky, because then I always know I'm really far from home. And I do get that sort of childish, impish thrill that, like, no one in the world knows where I am. And there's not a feeling I like better than that.
Do you get that, or have you gotten that from acting to some degree, this sense of connection, but also, you know, inhabiting a kind of character that's not you?
Yeah, again, the paradox of that. I found myself in acting. You know, the first play I did, I was in high school, and I was cut from the high school basketball team, and my mother said, go try out for the play, dear. And I was like, I don't want to be in a play. And I did. I went, and I was the Artful Dodger in Oliver, and I've really been playing the same part ever since.
Oh, you know? Is that right?
Yeah, I really do. A version of it. And it was that experience, that great, it's that famous Tennessee Williams line, because he said it better than I ever could, and it captured that a room that was always half in the dark was suddenly in the light. And that's how I felt about my life. I felt like I was present and fully me for the first time ever. And it was a feeling that, and then I knew I would be an actor. There was no discussion. There was no thought of what am I going to do. That's what I'm following. There was nothing to say about it.
And you went on to NYU?
I did. I went to NYU for a couple of years till they kicked me out. And then I just became an actor. It's interesting because when I became an actor, I got the job by going to an open call, which was like winning the lottery, really. And I went with, you know, to open, and I had 20 auditions, I think, to get the part. And when they finally gave me the part, I was completely thrilled, but I wasn't surprised at all. You know, I just felt like, yeah, that's my life. This is what I'm doing. And so it was that sense of joy and freedom, but it also felt deeply familiar already.
Did they kick you up because you were a bad student, or you didn't do your homework?
I didn't
go to classes. All of the above.
I went to my acting classes, but I wasn't interested in my regular school classes. So, I mean, I was a kid. I didn't know. I wanted to act, and so that's what I went to. And I hardly even noticed I was kicked out, really.
Because you weren't going there anyway.
Right? I wasn't really going, yeah.
And your first movie was Class.
Class, it was called, yeah.
And you were 19
years old, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I got the job because there was an ad in a newspaper that said, wanted, 18, vulnerable and sensitive. And my friend saw it in the newspaper, called me up. And I went, I'm 18, vulnerable and sensitive. So I went to an open call, which is just a cattle call, which anybody can show up. And I did, with 500 other 18, vulnerable and sensitive kids, and waited and met a guy. Mm-hmm. And he said, come back tomorrow. I came back tomorrow. And eventually, that was that.
It was interesting, too, to read about the kind of courtship, I guess, that goes on when a part is offered to somebody, as you described, you know, meeting people and flying places and meeting in hotel rooms and trying to figure out if you're right for the part and who are these people.
Yeah, I don't think that really exists anymore, but it was. I was flown. I did a number of auditions, and I was flown to Chicago to audition again for some reason, because that's where the film was being shot. And then I had to fly out and meet Jacqueline Bisset, who was the star of the movie, and I was to be her young lover, so she had to approve me. So I was driven up to Bendit Canyon to Jacqueline Bisset's house and sat down in her living room and had a little face-to-face with her and fell instantly in love with her. And she looked at me for about 5 seconds and said,
he'll do.
I like him, you know, and off we went.
You do, and we won't spend a lot of time going over the various movies that you were in early in your career, but nonetheless, it helped to establish you as an actor. But you also write about the fact that by the age of 29, you were in detox, and I guess young, early success has its casualties.
Well, yeah, certainly. And I was in detox and in rehab, but I have always thought that would have happened to me anyway. I don't think success particularly did. It may have exacerbated it, and I was certainly drinking more expensive vodka than I would have otherwise. But I think those same tendencies, I think it's Carl Jung says that alcoholism is a low-level spiritual search, you know, and I think that was why I was after it. You know, it was just misguided and ignorant kind of, and I was looking for relief and trying to solve that problem we were talking about, of that what's connection and how do I keep myself? And particularly, I was very public then, and so I felt like I couldn't bring myself along, and I felt very exposed and all those kind of things. So all that exacerbated it, I'm sure. But I think it was pre-existing condition on my part that would have happened no matter what.
You do talk, not in great detail, but you do talk a little bit about growing up. You grew up in New Jersey. Mm. Your parents, your dad in particular, who seemed like he had a temper that was, when he was angry, was a pretty scary thing to behold.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because it's just my childhood. Everyone has their own, and so you don't notice it's that sort of different, or I don't know if it was different. But my dad did have a temper, and it was... And I was a fearful kid anyway, and I became a fearful adult, and I think that just, that temper frightened me. I don't think I ever got angry myself until I stopped drinking. You know, I don't think I ever lost my temper until I was 30, you know? So it certainly had an effect on me in that way. And it, you know, but I, as I grew older, I found that a lot of my father's temper really came from his fear, you know, and his fear of, you know, the classic fears, am I man enough? Can I take care of these people I love? And that feeling of lack. And I think anger is a good way to exert control in a situation we're afraid of, you know, and I think that's what happened to him. Because when I see myself behaving in similar ways with my kids, I realize this is just, I'm acting like my dad and I'm afraid right now. Oh, that's why he did it.
Right.
You know, that whole thing that we don't forgive our parents till we become the ones ourselves.
Exactly.
And,
I hear the words coming
out.
Yeah,
and
right?
I'm like, I can't believe I said that. So, yeah, it was certainly fraught growing up in that way, but that was just my situation, you know.
You went, I don't know, it's pilgrimage? I'm not sure if that's quite the right word, but nonetheless, about 20 years ago, went on the Camino de Santiago, which is this now famous, or I guess then famous, trail that the pilgrims did follow in I guess, southern France and
it's in
Spain.
Yeah, I picked it up in the south of France, and it was, yeah, the Camino de Santiago that, I guess, came in about the 8th century when it was... when the bones of St. James were supposedly discovered in Santiago de Compostela.
Yeah.
But what I think it was really about was the Christian reconquest of Spain. And so it's walk over there and get half your time in purgatory knocked off, and while you're doing it, kick those damn Moors out too. So I think it had a political purpose as well. But yeah, I found that that was a transformative experience in my life. I walked for a month or 5 weeks across Spain alone, and that changed me.
We're almost up at a break here, but did you go there you wanted to get away, or you wanted to see whether you could walk alone by yourself or alone on a unfamiliar trail?
Well, I'd never backpacked, I'd never hiked, I'd never done any of that. I suppose in hindsight, the reason was I went to see if I could take care of myself.
And that's Andrew McCarthy, our guest today on Radio Times. He has been an actor for much of his adult life, or I should say all of his adult life. He's also a world-class travel writer, in fact, editor-at-large for National Geographic Traveler. He's received numerous travel journalism awards, including 4 2011 North American Travel Journalist Awards, and he's also the author of a new book that we are talking about. It's called The Longest Way Home, and it's a subtitle, One Man's Quest for the Courage to Settle Down. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
AT12 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. Now on stage, This Is the Week That Is, the election special, written and performed by Philadelphia's own Jennifer Childs and the This Is the Week That Is ensemble. 1812's annual political satire features a script that changes with the headlines and up-to-the-minute reporting on all the news that's fit to skewer. Tickets available at 215-592-9560 or at 1812productions.org.
I'm Mike and Scott. Listener support is vital to WHYY, and we'll be asking for yours during our upcoming membership campaign. But the October buyback is your chance to help give us a head start. Make a pledge during our October buyback, and for every 750 donations we receive, you'll buy back one day. This means one less day of pledge and one more day of news without membership breaks. Do your part at whyy.org/support. Thank you.
After months of heated campaigning, President Barack Obama and Republican nominee Mitt Romney will meet for their first debate in the battleground state of Colorado. The topics? Domestic issues. The economy, health care, the role of government, and how they would govern as president over the next 4 years. I'm Guy Raz. Join us this evening for special coverage of the first presidential debate from from NPR News.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Andrew McCarthy about some of his adventures in far-flung parts of the world and what he has learned about himself along the way. And he has enjoyed a long career as an actor, and he's also has a second career, I guess we could say, as a travel writer, and all of that coming together in his new book, The Longest Way Home, One Man's Quest for the Courage to Settle Down. Going back to your trip in on the Camino de Santiago, you talk about being miserable, lonely, and anxious. Those are your words, as you sort of freaked out at, and, you know, one section of your travel there. And it seems that that's a place where people have these kinds of moments of really staring at themselves or their life and having some kind of insight about it.
Well, I think walking does that. I think walking, particularly solitary walking, and the rhythm of that, it just wears you down till there's nothing left but you with yourself, you know? And that's certainly what happened to me. I was walking through, I'd been walking for several weeks, and I was miserable, as you say, lonely, anxious, mm-hmm. blisters. I was, what am I doing here? Mm-hmm. The only reason I didn't go home was because I'd told all my friends that I was going to walk across Spain for 5 weeks, and if I came home after two, they'd realize I was a complete phony. And so vanity drove me on, and ego. And so, yes, I had that experience. I was walking, and I just suddenly found myself on my knees sobbing and like a cartoon character of myself, shaking, literally shaking my fist at the heavens and screaming at God and cursing and doing all the things my Catholic upbringing had promised me I'd go straight to hell for. So, and I had that kind of tantrum, breakdown, whatever you want to call it. And then after that, I had a huge relief, you know, and I suddenly, that's when I became aware, really, in a word, that fear lifted off me, I suppose, for the first time in my life. And that changed my life. That the awareness of that fear had been such a wet blanket over me, and the relief of it was a huge thing.
And do you think set you on your adventures around the world?
Well, I certainly felt like myself. My wife is Irish, and she has a saying: "I feel like myself from the toes up." And I felt like myself from the toes up after that happened. I said, "This is who I am." Same feeling I had when I first acted. When I first did The Artful Dodger, it was like, "There I am, mm-hmm. there I am," and I was that feeling is. And it had gotten so clouded with so many things. And so, yes, I wanted more of it. And and acting had become in a certain way already kind of so complicated with success and then anxieties about that. And so travel, I found a very pure expression of that there I am quality. And so I started traveling the world, really searching always for that feeling, that moment of there I am.
I mean, such a cliched question about whether, the person that you have met as a traveler is your better self.
Yeah, I've always said that. I think I'm a much better version of myself right. on the road. I'm more open. I'm more curious. I'm braver. I'm just more right-sized in a certain way. I ask for help in a way that I never do at home. And I think the minute we ask for help, we open our hearts in a way that brings us to our truer selves, to our right size. And nobody's ever said no to me. When I ask someone for help, I go, "Hi, can you help me?" People just look at you, and they melt too. And suddenly we have that connection, and that's what I'm always after. You know? And it's interesting for someone who's so afraid and sort of internal right. to always be seeking connection. So that's another of those paradoxes. I'm always looking for that connection, and yet then I'm fleeing it in a certain way. So that is a challenge.
Can you hold on to that? When you get back to your regular life, your non-travel life, can you hold on to those feelings, those experiences that you've had as a traveler? I mean, I think as someone that just takes a vacation, you know, you try to hold on to that vacation feeling and watch it sort of slip through your fingers over time. Can you hold on to some of those things that you have?
Yeah, vacations are different. I mean, I'm all for vacations, but I often come back from traveling in need of a vacation. But no, of course, the minute I get home and, you know, it's like empty the dishwasher and it's, what happened? I mean, I just, you know, yeah, it's gone. It seems it's gone instantaneously by the time I get home from the airport. But I think there's deep internal changes that happen that are that are substantial, you know, and there's always sliding back. But that's what we do in life. We sort of one step up, two steps back, three steps up, you know, and so it's that's normal. And the only thing that traveling extensively does is makes me aware of that and my habits and when I'm back. And so I go, oh, this is this phase of that.
Right. Your book is about your life, but also it's about meeting this woman who you call D, the letter D, in your book. And I don't think it's a spoiler alert to say that you did marry her, because that's, in a sense,
Well, that's how the book starts.
That
yes,
is the book begins.
But I didn't want to write. There was no. I didn't want in any way to be writing this kind of false suspense, will he or won't he? Because it wasn't at all the event of the book. You know, we have a life. We have a child of my son from my previous marriage, and very content. And it was more of a how will he get married in a certain sense? Because I felt all these things we've been talking about. That sort of sense of pull, solitary pull, and yet pull for these people I love. And how do I reconcile that? I mean, the notion of the book came to me. I was in the back of a taxi going to Patagonia to do a story for a magazine. And we had just finally, we'd been engaged for years, and we finally decided, yes, let's get married. And so I was really sad to be going because we were feeling close the way people do when you make that, and we're feeling very intimate. And then, so I'm sitting in the back of the cab feeling really upset that I'm leaving, and yet at the same time, I was so excited to be going and going by myself. And I thought, what the hell is wrong with me? How do these two things coexist? And I set out to solve that, really, because, I mean, that was a question I needed to answer on many levels. You know, success as an actor came, and then I was frightened of it, and I wanted to pull back and leave me alone, and yet I wanted it because it gave me things that I wanted, and it made me feel powerful in a way that I wanted, and yet I was frightened by it. So that kind of push-pull and ambivalence and expansion-contraction has been plagued me my whole life. So it was an interesting dilemma, and I think it was probably one of the things that contributed to my first marriage not working. It was my constant, without even knowing it, I was, you know, one foot was always pointed, and I didn't want that. I didn't want to be that way. I didn't want to be that guy.
But it seems that Dee, and I don't know whether she understood this about you instinctively or sort of learned to understand that there was this part of you that, whether it was ambivalence or wanderlust or this need to be alone, that seemed to be so much a part of you. And I don't know whether she accepted that or fought you over it or struggled with it herself.
Well, it's interesting because she's the most gregarious and outgoing person I've ever met. And so we're constantly struggling with, come on, let's go out with these people. And I'm like, but we saw them last week.
In fact, she says, you never want to see anyone. That's one of her complaints.
I do. I mean, I have friends, and they're my friends. I don't need to see them. I know they're my friends. And she's like, can't we see them every night? I'm like, so it yes, I don't know if it's opposite to attract or it's just I'm being punished. But or she's being punished. But I've forgotten your question.
Well, just sort of whether she has come to accept this part of yourself. And obviously, this is your struggle. I think we all struggle with wanting to be ourselves alone and wanting to be with somebody.
Yeah, I mean, I it's who I am in a certain very real way, and I do come back home the better version of myself, you know. And she also has a very vibrant life of her own, and so she's happy to have her time. You know, I come home from travel sometimes, and she says, what are you doing? We're just getting a rhythm here without you. Get back up Kilimanjaro, buddy, you know.
You said to her at one point, I hate you for how much I love you.
Yeah, I think particularly loving children, too, is a horrible thing. It's a terrible to be that vulnerable and that open. I've often cursed, and people go, don't say that. And I go, I hate them for how much I love them. I do, because I just think it's a terrible, you know, but every parent has this. And that kind of vulnerability is, you know, I've strived to not feel that way. And yet, you know, that's the very feeling that we need, isn't it?
It is indeed. And that's Andrew McCarthy, our guest today on Radio Times, talking about his new book. It's called The Longest Way Home, One Man's Quest for the Courage to Settle Down. It's a memoir. It also has, I would say, travel log sections, or certainly travel writing and travels in the book as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I was interested that you have... Would fear of flying be too much?
No.
I mean,
terror,
fear of flying. And I'm assuming, you know, flying to Patagonia and all these, you know, the Amazon and other places that you've been, you have to get in tiny little airplanes and really scary looking airports. And
I do get into a lot of little planes, yeah. But since that trip to Spain, when I realized fear was so prevalent in my life, I realized it just wasn't going to stop me from doing things I needed to do and wanted to do. Once I can identify fear for being fear, then I go, okay, then I'm doing that. I mean, I think the trick is fear masquerades as many things. But in fear of flying, it's so blatantly what it is, and it's a fear of, you know, this control and all that kind of stuff. So I just kind of go, well, tough luck, buddy, you know, and off you go. But I think it's more a question of identifying fear that is the challenge, whatever that fear may be.
One thing I do is see if I'm in a disaster movie or not. So when I get on the airplane, you know, is there the nun, the bickering couple, the child with a fatal disease? And if I see them, then I know I'm in a disaster movie.
Great. Now I've got something else to worry about. Thanks. Yeah. I'll look around more.
You did go to Patagonia.
Although I have to interrupt. My wife always says to me when we're on a – when we're getting on a plane, she goes, you act like it's the last plane out of Saigon or something. Because right. I do get in very stressed survival mode the minute I'm in an airport.
And once you get on the plane and
you're in the air. Oh, it gets worse. It just gets worse.
Until you land terra firma.
And then we're fine.
And then you're fine. You did go to Patagonia with the beautiful, obviously, descriptions, interested in seeing glaciers and seeing how people lived up there. When you plan a trip, do you have an itinerary?
Well, it depends if I'm writing for a magazine or if I'm just going on my own. I rarely get to go on my own anymore because of time and things. But, yeah, I like to show up with know what story I'm going to go report. Yeah, right. For sure. And then, like anything, the more prepared you are, then the more I can throw it out the window and just go with what's really happening. But if I'm not prepared and I'm winging it the whole time, I'm very tense, and so I'm not open to meeting and finding the experiences that pass right in front of me. So, again, I like to know and then get rid of it.
Yeah. There's descriptions of your trip on the Amazon. In fact, it seemed like you saw, when other people didn't see, a young girl who had a serious, disease in her mouth. You were with a group and had pulled up to a village, and people were talking to the children and perhaps giving them toys and presents or whatever. And you noticed this little girl. What did you see about her?
Yeah, I mean, well, that's one of the things being a sort of solitary person does. Right. You sort of suddenly notice other solitary. You know, that's if you're a group person, you notice the group. If you're a loner, you notice the loner. And so there was a girl sitting off in a little floating canoe off by the side, and she was the size of my daughter, reminded me of my daughter. And she was six. And she had her tongue was very swollen out of her mouth. And it turned out I asked the people on the boat afterward what the situation was. And she just had a blood clot in her tongue that she needed a 90-minute operation in Lima and to unclog the clot. And she would be fine. But her tongue had swollen so much that she wasn't able to eat and she would die soon. And so I mentioned it to, which I would never have done. I was surprised I did. And I mentioned it to the people on the boat, and then they were uncomfortable by me bringing it up, and so it was dropped. And then days later, right when we were getting off the boat, they all came up to me one at a time and gave me their cards and said, if you can do anything for that girl, if you know the owner of the boat, then we'd like to help. And so I contacted the owner of the boat, and mentioned that this girl and that the people would like to do something. And he took the ball in his hands, and he did everything and took care and got her the operation. She's completely fine now.
Well, I mean, it's quite a story.
It is, you know, it was lovely and it was very nice. It's one of those strange, sensitive kind of things. So it's like, the rich white people are going in and helping the poor natives kind of. So it has a self-congratulatory aspect. I was very hesitant to sort of relay it but ultimately this girl's situation improved a lot. And so I think that's all to the good.
Well, and sometimes maybe this is what you have found as someone who has traveled the world, which is travel can bring out goodness in people that they might not express in their normal everyday life. They might pass a homeless person and pay them no mind in their
Absolutely.
Regular life.
Absolutely. It certainly does in me. And I think it certainly did with all those folks on the boat. I don't know that they would have done that if they had been, like you say, trudging down Fifth Avenue and saw someone.
Right.
You know.
You also described a drink, a kind of a mystery drink that you and I thought, boy, this guy's brave because you hold it up to the light and it's a strange color and consistency.
Yeah, I was in a market in Belen in Iquitos in the Amazon, and amazing market. You know, I love markets because they reveal cities for what they are instead of what they want to present. You know, street markets are just raw and unguarded. You know, people getting their needs met, and I love them, and I love going to them. And yeah, I drank a love elixir.
Yes, a love elixir. And but it sounded like you were hallucinating afterwards.
I don't know what happened, really. I don't know.
You were feeling very, very good.
I just
though,
felt
yes?
really good. And everything was just so sensuous and delicious for a while, and I wished I wasn't alone. So I think it had some, right. It worked, whatever it was.
And are there do you have, when you're traveling, certain things you won't eat or you won't drink, or do you have rules about this, or you just try to be spontaneous and read the situation?
No, I don't have any rules, but I'm not a great, I don't find my way into a culture through food. You know, I'm not a foodie, so I will eat, what's in front of me, but it's not my way in. So, but I don't have any particular rules. I just try and stay sort of open to the deal.
And have you gotten sick on the road?
Rarely. My one travel tip to people who ask me is I take grapefruit seed extract, which is this horrible tasting little drops, and it kills any bacteria in your stomach. That's my experience, and it's been great. I think I've gotten sick not in years.
And are there places that you haven't been that you'd like to go? I mean, do you have your bucket list?
Well, I hope it's not a bucket list. I hate that term, actually.
But I'd
like to go to Burma now that it's opening up before the McDonald's gets there. I'd like to go there. I'd like to go to the Atacama Desert because I find deserts really potent and powerful. I'd like to go to Bhutan. You know, I'm curious to go anywhere, really. Right. I'm very open to going. I like the act of going and arriving. So I'll go anywhere.
And are McDonald's everywhere? I mean, are you finding that? in places you would never expect?
Yes and no. Yes and no. I mean, there's still the wide world out there. There was nothing in Iquitos. You know, there was no McDonald's down in Patagonia. You know, there was no McDonald's at Kilimanjaro. Yeah. I know. I've gone lots of places where it's still foreign out there. You know, the world's not as small as we are trying to dismiss it being. I think that's another excuse not to go anywhere.
And do you learn the language or learn a couple words? How important is that to you?
I'm a terrible self-conscious linguist. I speak very bad Spanish, which I'm unabashed about, but I generally go, "Hi, do you speak English?" That's me. I try and say it with some sort of form of charm and humility so I'm not the total ugly American. But no, I find people, whether they can understand me or not, always help me. And I find it a great sort of barrier because they know, but my friend, and they take me to their friend's house, and suddenly I'm at the friend's house for dinner because he speaks 10 words of English. And I have great experiences. So as long as I'm not afraid, you know, use the language as a barrier. It's never been a barrier.
Your book begins where you and Dee are on the road and you're on your honeymoon.
Yeah, we're in Mozambique.
And you're rushing to get to the airport and, you know, one terrible thing happens after another. The car breaks down but she ends up laughing her head off.
Well, it captures very much who I was stressing because I was like, I should be in control of the situation. I'm not handling it well. We're failing. I'm emasculated. I should never have gotten married. I should be alone. This is terrible. Mm-hmm. And she, of course, sees the sort of ridiculousness and the joy and everything. So it's a good, it set us up who we are completely. She found it hysterical. I found it humiliating.
So you were berating yourself.
Yeah, I was berating myself and she was laughing that this is like the most ridiculous thing that's ever happened to me and how are we going to get out of this? And that's pretty much sums us up. She found the sort of appetite and joy in it and I found the strain of it.
And this is a broken down car in a remote part of...
Yeah, we're in the remote part of Mozambique and we were heading to the airport and our car broke down. There was no spare tire and we were just trapped and sort of we're on the side of a road, dirt road, that no one had passed us for hours and no one would pass for hours.
And she's laughing hysterically.
We started to hear then sort of drumming as dawn broke. Mm-hmm. This was in the middle of the night and then finally dawn broke and there was this pound, these sort of war drums pounding and she thought that was hysterical and we both kind of said, well, I hope they're not coming to eat us.
Yeah, which they were.
They did not.
Clearly
not, yeah.
And you made it on to the rest of your honeymoon.
Well, that sort of ended the honeymoon.
Another short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Andrew McCarthy. He has or is an actor. He's also directed some plays as well. And he's written a book called The Longest Way Home, One Man's Quest for the Courage to Settle Down. And we have just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Chemical Heritage Foundation, Library, Museum, Center for Scholars, supports WHYY. CHF, together with the Philadelphia Artists Collective, will present a reading of Ben Jonson's classic farce, The Alchemist. In this raucous adventure, the allure of gold makes it easy for a ragtag band of con artists to dupe a town of greedy nitwits. Monday, October 8th at 7 p.m., CHF's new exhibit, The Alchemical Quest, will also be on display. More information at chemheritage.org/events.
Phil? Phil Connors? Phil Connors, I thought that was you.
How you doing? Thanks for watching.
Hey.
Character actor Stephen Tobolowsky was Bill Murray's annoying high school friend in Groundhog Day. He's also had recurring roles in Heroes, Deadwood, Californication, and Glee. We'll talk with Tobolowsky about his new memoir on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A reporter just back from Afghanistan says despite insider attacks, U.S. troops want more engagement with Afghan troops. Also, when President Obama and Mitt Romney debate each other, should fact-checkers be on hand? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and if you're just joining us, Andrew McCarthy is our guest. He's an award-winning travel writer. In fact, his book is called The Longest Way Home, about his desire for the road and his struggles to be connected with his family. We're talking about some of his adventures in far-flung parts of the world and some things that he has learned about himself as he has traveled the world. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get some callers in. Looks like we have Mike from Woodstown, New Jersey. And Mike, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Hi. Thank you. Congratulations. Another unbelievable show.
Oh,
great.
Thank you.
I've got a comment and then a question, and I'll take it off the air.
Fair enough.
First of all, I have to tell Andrew that I always sort of liked him as an actor. And as I listen to this interview, I like him a whole lot more because he seems to be the same neurotic gypsy that I am, so I can identify with that.
There you go.
Thank you.
I'm quite impressed with his travel dossier here, and I will run right out and get his book. My question is this. Actually, twofold. Number one, does Andrew feel that this travel has made him a kinder, gentler soul, if you will, in all venues of his life? I find that since I've been traveling quite a bit, I can't pass up somebody standing by the side of the road that needs a dollar, a couple bucks for food, if they're hungry, whatever. I just can't do it. And I do attribute that different feeling I have to what I've learned traveling.
That's interesting.
So I was curious if Andrew felt the same on that.
Well, Mike,
question.
Let's take that one only because we've got some other callers.
Thank you.
I want to give Andrew McCarthy a chance to weigh in. Has it made you a kinder, gentler person?
Yeah, absolutely. It's made me a more open person to the world and consequently, a better person. Absolutely, without a doubt. I mean, that touches a whole bigger thing of, see, I think America's a great, great country, but America's, to me, a very fearful place and people make very fearful choices. I think a lot of our political choices are very fearful. And I think if Americans traveled, they would lose a lot of that fear. And if we lost a lot of that fear, the world would respond to us differently, and because we'd be making different choices and the world would be a better place. And my whole soapbox is changing the world one trip at a time, really. You know, and so I think that great Mark Twain line, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness, is absolutely true in my experience. And so, yes, it makes me a much kinder person, more open. And when I see a guy staring down at a map in New York, I go, can I help you?
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Sort of etiquette and connection, commonality on the road. Mike, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Do you think it's changed you as an actor? Has it made you a better actor, you think, to be such a passionate traveler?
Sure. Anytime you have more experiences, you have more things in your tool chest. But again, on the more human level, it's opened me to be more relaxed in myself. And the more relaxed you are as an actor, the better you are as an actor. I mean, Laurence Olivier said that the key to acting is relaxation. So, yes, it's relaxed me in my nervous system very much. So it certainly does, yeah.
Are there certain parts that are certain kinds of roles that you are attracted to as an actor?
That's interesting. No, not particularly. There's certain kinds I'm always offered, which seem to have nothing really to do with who I am, and yet you were successful in a role, and so you're given more of the same. And so there's that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But no, I'm not particularly attracted to any kind of role. No, I just always find myself playing the same ones, and that's
frustrating.
Well, it's frustrating. I understand it, and it's fine. Luckily, I'm very grateful I have another outlet creatively in the writing. Otherwise, I would find that very frustrating.
But do you think that goes back to that, you know, the sort of Brat Pack moniker that you've had to live under?
Yeah, sure. But that's been a real mixed bag. When it happened at the time, it was, you know, I hated it, and I, you know, any kind of label and stigmatizing thing is not good for any actor, and I think it was a real pejorative term at the beginning.
Very condescending.
Yeah, it was very condescending. It was, and I mean, it was so. But now it's become this kind of iconic, kind of capturing a moment in time, which I think is, why not?
Go for it, right?
Yeah, I mean,
own it.
Sure. It's. I could land on Mars, and the title will be Andrew Brat Pack McCarthy Lands on Mars.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's there.
There you go. Let me see what Suzanne from Abington has to say. Suzanne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I'm enjoying the show very much, I've gotten to travel a lot myself, and I always feel like, oh, I need to go away to experience this. But my question is when you're not away, how do you have time for yourself? Or do you find it necessary to pull away from everything and find time to go in yourself and capture all the things that you've had on the road when you're in your everyday life? And I'll take my question if.
Suzanne, thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
I have no time for any of that when I'm home. So I go to I take a shower. That's my only kind of privacy in my
long
home.
Long shower.
Two small kids. So, but yeah, I think that is the challenge all the time, and finding that balance and trying carving that space out. Because again, if I don't have me for a minute, I can't come to you. I just can't. But I rarely get it, and so that's just the nature of the beast.
But do you find sort of I'm not saying tension, but sort of a buildup that if you haven't been on the road for a while, you feel this wanderlust, as we call it?
I do. It does tend to build and grow in me, and it's like, I gotta go. I do have that feeling, and luckily I'm doing a lot of articles and things that it does take me, right. But I do have that feeling of it's time very well spent to me, time on the road. I don't find travel a frivolous thing. I find travel an imperative in my life.
It's interesting we call it wanderlust. I mean, as if there is something sort of lusting or even sexual.
I've been accused of saying that travel is an infidelity of a certain kind, and I think that that's true, because infidelity is, I'm not talking sexually, infidelity is something that you do privately away from your loved ones, and I think that's what travel is. It's this intimacy that you have with your experience of yourself on the road that is leaving behind the people that you love. And you can only have that if you leave them behind, if they're with me, even emotionally to a large degree, which they are. But the minute you can really leave it behind and you have that sort of infidelity, it's very potent and powerful. And all I can bring back to you is the story of what happened. So it's between me and the world.
You also have a chapter of traveling with your family, what became your family, to Vienna. And what you learned there as well. I mean, again, you had this desire to go out and be by yourself, but there you were with I guess she was your fiance, your future to be parents-in-law, kids in a big city.
Yeah, I mean, there's such a, my now in-laws, and they're such an Irish inclusive, everybody's in everybody's face all the time, knows everybody's business, and I don't know how they function like that, but it's the only way they can function, and it's so the opposite of who I am. So I just thought it was ridiculous, my trying to live my life the way that I would want to, ordered and sort of contemplative to some degree, or considered anyway, when they're just living a free-for-all. And so I was trying to juxtapose those and try to come to terms with that. And, you know, at the end, I think they're probably much happier.
but do they accommodate your eccentricities?
Well, they try to in a certain way of, well, Andrew needs to go do this. Go on, Andrew. And then 10 seconds later, they're like, Andrew, come here. And so, no, they can't understand it to a large degree. Mm-hmm. It's like my wife understands my sort of desires and sort of personality traits, and yet because she doesn't share them, she can't really comprehend them on any real way, because she can't identify with them. She can sort of empathize with them sometimes, but she can't comprehend, I can't comprehend her need for such constant social interaction. For both of us, I think they're a strain. it's hopeless, but that's the point, isn't it? That it is hopeless, and we do it. That's the great sort of triumph, is that it's absolutely impossible, and yet we must do it. And that's what being alive is, isn't it? I don't want to be allowed to go off on my own and live in a cave for my whole life. That would be horrible for me. Yet I need to go do that, and I feel like I yearn for it. And yet what I really probably need is that connection and being dragged from that cave. If I were in a cave, I'd be no good to anybody.
But it seems like she understands that about you.
In theory.
Practice maybe something else. Yeah, I understand that, exactly. Let me get Sandra from Harleysville to join us on Radio Times. Sandra, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi
there.
I had Mr. McCarthy touched on this with another caller, saying that often he feels Americans are fearful when wanting to travel, and I think he got a little bit of pushback on that when he said that on Piers Morgan show. A lot of people had responded back saying that Americans are poor, or the economy kind of prevents Americans from traveling, especially abroad. And I was wondering, basically, if he feels Americans kind of use that as a crutch, maybe.
Saying they can't afford to travel and that's why they
exactly,
don't?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right, Sandra. Let me take your question and we'll see what Andrew, were you on Piers Morgan?
I was, yeah. And I do. I think that's a bunch of nonsense. I think, you know, we don't, Americans don't travel because of fear, period. And I'm not talking about vacations. There's a book on the bestseller now, a travel book about called The Kindness of Strangers, about a guy who travels the world without a penny. I've proved to my friends that I could say I spend less money on the road than I do at home. I think we don't travel because we're afraid to, period. And money, yes, you know, I'm generalizing and being provocative about it, but I think to the very, 30% of Americans have passports. Half of them have ever used them. Many of our congressmen don't own passports. It's outrageous to me. And that, so I do think fear is the main contributing factor for why people don't go out.
Sandra, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Did your family travel as a kid? I mean, sounds like it was a pretty...
No, we grew up in Jersey and, you know, went to the Jersey Shore and then for the summer. But no, for once a week, you know, 1 week in the summer. No, we didn't travel. No one I knew traveled. It was just something that happened to me.
And is your dad still alive?
Yeah, he lives up in Maine now.
Because you have, again, a section of the book where you go and visit him. Is he... Does he enjoy your success as a travel writer and an actor?
Yeah, I think so. I think my dad is very proud of it. When I was in high school on the basketball team, whenever I would score a basket, he was the guy in the audience in the stands screaming, "That's my boy!" You know, and I was humiliated by this at 14. But I think he still is the guy up in Maine going, "That's my boy." Yeah.
But does it feel any better?
No, it's nice now.
It's nice. Yeah. Oh, that's good. That's good. Let me get, looks like Paul from Drexel Hill to join us on Radio Times. And Paul, go ahead, you're on the air. Go ahead, you're on the air,
Hello.
Paul.
Hi, Marty, and hi, Andrew. I am calling. 3 years ago, I went on a trip to Italy, and I had planned it with kind of the general idea that it would just be a good time. And I went to stay with two families on an organic farm and work there. So I went with the kind of general idea and intention that it would just be good for me, but came back with very specific things like lessons and life lessons learned, like lessons in patience and humility and hospitality and things like that, very great things. So what I was wondering from Andrew is that on his first kind of solitary trip that he planned, did he go with intentions that or approach it with specific goals or awareness that it would achieve these great things for him throughout that would contribute to his life and his life perspective?
That's an interesting question, Paul. Whether that first trip you went looking for the kinds of things that Paul was describing.
No, I didn't have any of that kind of awareness of myself. That first trip I took alone really was walking across Spain, and it was really just that feeling of, I don't know why I did it. I read a book, and a week later I was in Spain. I read a book about it called Off the Road by this fellow named Jack Hitt, who wrote about his walk on the Camino, and I suddenly just did it. But I find exactly what you're saying to be my experience on the road now. And I often go for selfish reasons and end up coming back selfishly improved by it.
Huh. Does it feel that way, selfishly improved?
Well, I'm improved in the sense that I get so much more than if I go and help somebody or do something, I've always gotten so much more out of it, you know, in the way that people always talk about. But that's what I mean by selfishly improved. And I come back so much better for it. No matter what I've done for them or whatever, I come back so much richer for it, you know?
Do you enjoy those reunions, you know, when you come back from a trip and you get to see your family again and I don't know if you have a dog or, you know, any of those things?
Yeah, I mean, I love going away, but my favorite feeling is coming across the Triborough Bridge and seeing Manhattan again, you know, but... Yes, for the first 5 minutes I'm home, they're thrilled to see me. And then everybody's like, take care of the kids, I got to go out. And the dishwasher's full. So it's like, whoa, okay, yeah. I'm back. But... Yeah, it's just a normal rhythm of coming and going, and it just happens to me more than most people, I suppose.
You climb Mount Kilimanjaro, not an easy thing to do, and you were hurt, I guess. You had a bum knee at the time.
Yeah, I mean, Kilimanjaro is an interesting thing because anyone can climb Kilimanjaro. It requires no technical skill. Grandmothers get up Kilimanjaro, and yet people who are in incredible shape often don't. It's just altitude, how you respond to altitude or not. And it's just a long walk. It's 4 days of kind of nice uphill walking and 1 day of hell. You know, so it's totally doable, and it's whatever games your mind sort of plays with you.
But there was someone in the group that wanted to stay up there. And
right, yeah. On my trip, we camped on the summit, which most people don't. They go back down to 15,000 feet, and one of our guys wanted to stay at 20,000 feet. And because it was in the brochure, you know, if you wanted to stay, you had to. So we had one of those experiences of somebody insisting they inflicted the rest of us with their will, and we had to stay up there. And it was a horrible, miserable experience.
Well, it sounded like you were really angry. You were
furious. Well, it's interesting because this is what travel does. It illuminated something deeply personal. It wasn't about staying on top of the mountain. It was that somebody, I just felt very potent in myself, having climbed the top of this mountain, and yet somebody could then go, I want to do this, and I had lost all my power. Uh-huh. And so I was furious that I felt I'd lost my power. It wasn't about staying up there. It was about to, and so that triggered off a whole bunch of internal things in me about why do I feel I don't have enough power? Why all these kind of things? And then power is manhood, and then how do I feel about that? And what issue do I feel like I'm man enough for? So it triggers all these kind of internal things that happen. And he, of course, gets the blame for it. He's the jerk that's making this happen. But really what was upsetting me was my own sense of lack of power in myself that I'd had, you know, lifelong. And so that to me is exactly what travel is about. And it illuminates these kind of things about ourselves. It's been my university, travel.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much, Andrew McCarthy, for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. The book is called The Longest Way Home, One Man's Quest for the Courage to Settle Down. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, email, and the archives, podcast, Sirius Radio. It's all there. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscow. Thank you so much for joining us.